Happy Hero Day, everyone. Thank you for joining Extending the Olive Branch again for another amazing show. Today we have Glashonda joining us. She is a dear friend of mine, and she's very good with words and communicating. So that's what we're going to talk about this week. So let's welcome Glo to the show.
Hi, girl.
Hi.
Happy to be here.
Hey, thank you for coming and joining. I mean, you're not coming. You're in Tennessee, right?
Yes, Tennessee, East Coast.
East Coast. And so there's a lot of stuff happening in Tennessee with these people out here acting crazy. How are you doing up there?
You know, we're surviving. It's interesting because in the South, that type of stuff is pretty much normal. I don't want to say normal, but, you know, it happens often in the South. And even though racism, white supremacy, fascism is all over the United States, it's interesting to see the responses of people who don't have to live this experience every day. Mm-hmm. You know, just complete shock, like,
right.
Where has our country come to? And I'm like,
It's been this way.
These are the people I see at my bank and, yeah, you know, in the grocery store. This isn't new. So we're surviving out here, but I'm hoping some kind of change sparks out of this now that everybody is becoming more awake. And I just,
right, and they're talking about it and communicating about it. Yeah.
Yes.
So, I mean, I guess that's like interesting to move into this topic of communicating. But before we go into that, maybe can you tell our listeners what your aspirations and goals are in life so that we can kind of have a better understanding of who you are and where you're coming from?
Yeah. So I would say the big overarching aspiration for me right now is healing in our communities, communities of color, communities that have been historically oppressed, just living happy, fulfilled lives where we're not just surviving, but we're actually thriving, you know, like we can get back to the root of our joy on a daily basis. So that's my overarching aspiration, but then how I get there, you know, it's kind of the day-to-day things, being out in the streets, doing the work every day, having conversations with people, finding the little things that are my own joy.
Mm-hmm. It's always about you have to take care of yourself. Yes. That's good. Well, thank you for sharing that. I guess we can get into the communication piece. I guess I want to start with a little story about me when I was younger and communicating. So I'm originally from Kansas City, Missouri, and I moved to Minnesota probably around when I was 6. And but we moved to Minnesota, we left like kind of abruptly. And when we moved to a suburb in Minnesota, and the school I went to was pretty much basically the only black kid, me and my brother. And when I got there, I couldn't really participate in class. I got set in the back of the class. I couldn't participate. I couldn't talk. All the other kids got to talk, and whenever I wanted to participate, I would get shut down or looked at as I was acting out. So there came a time when I just stopped talking. And when my mother found out about everything that was happening, she moved us to the city because we were experiencing racism at that school. So we moved to the city, and I didn't want to talk because I was scared. Like, I just did not talk. And so I had to get put into one of those classes, like, that they put all the, I don't know what they call it. Do you know what they call those classes? Like the special classes?
Yeah.
I think back then it probably was special ed, but I don't really like that term.
Or the at-risk kids.
Yes. So I had to go to those classes, and they would always try to get me to talk and to read, and I just didn't want to. And so finally, probably after a few weeks of going, I finally took the book and read the book. And they're like, okay, this girl can read, and she can read well, and she can talk, so go back to class. So after, like, going through those experiences, I just think and reflect back on how much how important communication is and how it's always – how it may be affected by different experiences that happen in your life. So – and I know you dealt a lot you deal a lot with communication and trauma and early childhood development. So do you want to talk a little bit about that?
So my work was with kids who would be considered developmentally delayed on some level in any area of development. And I did a lot of work with parents at their most vulnerable, probably their most vulnerable times with their children when they're just finding out, you know, their child has a diagnosis, or I was the person who was doing testing because they were referred to us and I had to tell them their child was delayed based on the test results. And so that was one aspect of my work. And it was amazing, you know, how vulnerable parents and children were in that time. You know, I'm coming into their homes and working with them. And so communication was a big part of my job at that time, and trauma was a big part of it as well. And it really showed me that we had to expand how we do trauma. So before then, you know, I would say trauma was, you know, everybody would agree what trauma is. You get attacked in the street, or, you know, you lose someone close to you, or, you know, something, some life-changing event happened to you, you went to war, like, everyone would agree these are common definitions of trauma or examples of trauma. Mm-hmm. But really, trauma is so much bigger than that, and it does go into early childhood. And, like, I would say your experience of moving from, you know, Kansas City to the suburb of Minnesota and not seeing people who represent you or people that you are used to being around was a traumatic experience for little Lashana, you know, at 6 years old. And not many people would agree with that. I personally believe babies can experience trauma in utero, you know, before they're even born, and that can impact them once they are born. So I think we have to start expanding how we can see the trauma so we can start getting to the root of, like, solutions and making better spaces of healing for children, for adults who experience trauma.
And what got you into this work, and why is communication important to you?
Yeah, so I grew up with what they would call fluctuating hearing loss, which means I'm not like your typical deaf person. You know, when you say deaf, people have this idea in their mind, somebody who can't hear anything at all. Deafness is actually on the spectrum. You know, you have a range of hearing. And I'm not like your typical everyday hearing person who can hear all sounds and all communication. Mine changes based on who knows, because the doctors couldn't tell me. And so I decided to get, you know, involved with the deaf community and American Sign Language. And that was actually one of the reasons I moved to Minnesota, because in the South at that time, I actually grew up in the South, they didn't recognize American Sign Language as an official language of communication. Mm. And so, you know, coming to Minnesota opened that world to me, where I really believe I started to see the world and experience the world through a different lens. American Sign Language was my third language, so I grew up English and Spanish, and then American Sign Language. And so as a multilingual person, how I perceive the world informs, you know, even my definitions of trauma, my understanding of trauma, how I approach healing, because I don't come from that one perspective. It's a, you know, it's like a big, it's like a, kind of like glasses, you know, I can put on different glasses to look at one picture and see the picture in different ways each time.
Yeah. That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. I know, like, people may see, like, hearing loss as a disability, and sometimes that can affect how people are getting help. I know, like, sometimes in the Black community, they don't want you to have a disability because that means that something's wrong with you, or it's a reflection of on the parents or that family. What do you think about that, and how people see disabilities in the community, and how does that affect us?
Yeah, it's interesting in communities of color, and specifically the Black community. I feel how we see disability is part of our historical and generational trauma, because disabled people have been around since the beginning of time. But we bring in things like religion, and it says, oh, if you have a disabled child, this might be because you're being punished for a sin, or whatever the view people are bringing into it. But really, everybody is disabled in some way at some point of their lives, if we really look at it. And so I went through a disability justice training with an amazing trainer called Talila Lewis, and mm-hmm. I've been doing disability justice training with some amazing people in the field now. And we gave an example of a building, let's say a two-story building. If that building didn't have stairs, how would we, people who can walk, who we consider aren't disabled, get into the building? We couldn't. So, like, mm-hmm. stairs were made to make us feel comfortable. Stairs were made to make us feel not disabled. But then that isolated people who couldn't walk, people who couldn't use stairs, people who needed elevators and ramps and these type of things. And so, really, everybody is disabled. Every mind is disabled in some way. Think of somebody who only speaks English, who walks into a Spanish-only room. You're disabled in that moment because you don't have access to the language. But we don't conceive of it in that way. And obviously, you have people who have different minds, who have different bodies, who are able to function in different ways. So I'm not denying that disability, how it manifests in the world, is not real. No, but I'm saying that's true. And we have a society that tells us what's disabled and what's not. That's also affecting how we see it.
Right. And you spoke about communication and how you may walk into a room and, you know, someone speaking Spanish. But how did you deal with families who had to start communicating in a different way, or when you told these families that their children was not able to communicate or they're not being understood? How did the families take that, and like how, what did that do to the family or for the family?
Yeah, for a lot of families going in, like I said, it was one of the harder times of their lives. Sometimes they had older kids who they would consider, you know, typical, and they would compare, like, this younger child isn't doing what their sibling is doing. And so for me, it was more not necessarily fix your child. That's what the education system tells us, fix this child to perform like everyone else. Mm-hmm. But more to say to the family, how do you transform your life? How do you evolve to not accommodate the child, but to have a fully functioning, cohesive family that includes this child just like everyone else, that this child is a full functioning member of this family? And so the way we did that was through open conversations. And a lot of the families I worked with were not English speaking, so from different African countries, from Burma, Laos, you know, from all over. So I had to use interpreters and cultural brokers a lot of the times, and their cultural backgrounds influence how they perceive their child. So we're dealing with different cultures, different languages, and we're talking about one child from different sides or different perspectives. And so what I would try to explain to them is your child has just opened your door, opened your life into a whole other culture and language group. And so as a parent, like, you should be excited to embrace this opportunity, embrace the chance to get to know a different group of people, to get to know another language with your child, and not see this as something that is painful, something that is devastating to the family mm-hmm. unit.
Yeah. So, like, I can imagine that with that communication, there was confusion, there was maybe anger or, you know, just mm-hmm. not understanding. And we can see that sometimes with our peers. Sometimes our peers can have, like, violent communication or things like that. How do you navigate through the people in your everyday life with your background, knowing that, okay, this person is not communicating this way or because of this and that? Like, how do you navigate knowing that people are lacking that communication
mm-hmm.
in your adult
life? Funny, mm-hmm. because I'm going through this now with people in my life. And mm-hmm. I feel like in my experiences, it's not been so much of the violent lashing out as it's been closing oneself off and mm-hmm. refusing to communicate or not communicating or using communication as just the bare minimum, basic needs met type thing. And so with those people, it's like, what? I don't want to address the symptom. The symptom is you're not communicating. The symptom is you isolating yourself. The symptom is you avoiding people. And that might be how you feel you need to cope. I don't want to address the symptom. I want to address the root problem, what's causing the lack of communication. And so that's my motivation when I'm dealing with peers. Mm-hmm. But it's hard because they're adults, you know, and adults.
Yeah.
You get to choose to engage or not to engage, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is very, I know for me, sometimes I can be very blunt, you know, sometimes just like, okay, I'm just going to avoid this. Like, I don't want any conflict right now. So I'm just going to shut down. Or sometimes, you know, you hear things and it's like, okay, I hear what you're saying, but what are you not saying? And I like to listen to the right. things that people are not saying because, like, that's more telling to me than what they're actually saying. Because sometimes people are, like, they use words to lie. They, you know, to hide their feelings or to not have to deal with certain situations. So it's like, okay, I know that you have more there, and I'm trying to listen to that because I'm trying to pull out what you're not saying. And, you know, I had someone, like, I'm trying to get back out dating, you know. And someone, this guy, he approached me and he said, "Don't fall for me." And I was like, "Excuse me? You approached me?" And I was like, what you're saying is that, like, that's a loaded thing right there. Like, you're saying, okay, I have insecurities. I'm not who you think I am or whatever. It's like, why did you say that to me? Like, what are you doing? And I had to question that. And I'm like, why did you say that? And he was shocked. I'm like, listen, like, you can't do that. And I think that it's about kind of challenging conversation. Like, if something does not seem right to you or if, like, it's just, like, why did you say that? Like, how do you combat or fight that type of communication or those type of conversations with people who are not really saying what they feel or what they're truly, like, trying to say?
Yeah, I'm one of those people, like, I feel like people tend to just open up to me and say mm-hmm. things. But like you said, sometimes they're not always saying real things. Just mm-hmm. you're putting out words, but your real message is not really coming through. So I like to ask questions. I like to, you know, give examples from my own life and tell my own stories and put words to what they might really be feeling but don't know how to express. And I always welcome, like, for me, like you said, you're a blunt person. I'm a blunt person, too. And so, and I tell people this, but I think people have trauma from other people where I'm like, tell me straight up what it is. Just say it to me, whether it's hard, whether it, you know, comes out all wrong, might hurt my feelings. I don't care. What I value is the truthfulness in your words, no matter what that truth might be. And people take, you know, you'll say that to them and they're like, no, I don't think she really wants the truth. And tell lies. You know, and I'm like, no, I really am sure that I would rather have the truth from you right now. And so, yeah, asking questions and giving people words to map on to what they're feeling has been successful for me in the past. But I totally feel what you're saying.
Yeah, it's crazy. I know you are you're attending, was it Tennessee, what university?
University of Tennessee.
Yeah, and so you're dealing a lot with people, you're dealing a lot with people who are of different backgrounds from you. I mean, you're in Tennessee where they have the little KKK rally. So I can imagine that communicating in that type of space can be difficult. What experiences have you had in that space, and how have you been coping with that?
You know, it's been really hard. I recently read a thread that was saying that going through a PhD is one of the more traumatic experiences you'll have in your life if you choose to pursue one. And and on top of the PhD, it's even worse when you're a woman and a woman of color. So I'm thinking of what about trans, disabled people. When you're from a marginalized background who doesn't match that typical demographic of PhDs, it's even more traumatic. And so that's exactly what I'm going through right now, where I find myself, just like trying every day to find one thing that brings me joy to cope with it. I mean, I go through experiences where, one example, I went to a class, the first day of that class, the dean of the department was the instructor for the class. And I was on time, but she started 10 minutes early because she had the wrong class time. And so when I showed up, I was one of the last people to introduce myself. One of two persons of color in the class. The other person was half white and had grown up in that area. And so when I introduced myself, the teacher asked for something that was unique about me, or something, you know, they asked those types of questions. And so I said, you know, I speak three languages, Spanish is my second language. And her response was, you don't look like a Spanish speaker. And
you don't know my life.
And what does a Spanish speaker look like? And so it put me in a position, you know, like, do I say something back? Like, if I don't say something, how many other people would you say that to? And so, and that was just the first of 15 weeks in that class where I had to constantly challenge what was being said in the class, constantly correct racist, sexist, ableist comments being made in the class every week.
That sounds so tiring.
It's exhausting, and that's just one class, you know?
Yeah.
We're not talking about going to the grocery store and having racist people make comments to you. We're not talking about, you know, the daily things you have to go through outside of school. So it's been one of the more challenging couple of years in my life, but I am done in May. Hello.
Hey, congrats.
So one more year.
I'm happy for that, and you can get out of there.
Yes.
Right.
You know, I'm always ready to go. But but the hard part is that somebody has to do it. You know, if I'm not the one that's challenging these kind of comments, in these kind of spaces that make it unsafe for people like me and other diverse people who want to be in this field. If I'm not challenging it, who is, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it becomes frustrating because you feel that burden of, I bear it, not just for me, but for the woman of color or the disabled person of color that's going to come after me.
Right.
So
yeah, so like you're paving the way and like you're opening their eyes to something new. But mm-hmm. what I know it's like very challenging, but have there been rewarding parts of this for you? Like what has been like really good moments for you in like regards to communicating with these people and things like that?
I would say the really good moments have come when we come to an understanding that they know they can expect to come correct with me.
Do not play with me.
You know, and I mean, the communication part is important because it's as much as what you say as how you say it. Mm-hmm. And so one example, I had an email exchange with a person that's pretty high up in my department to call her out on her failure to address sexism that was directed towards me. And mm-hmm. so my email was very blunt, just said, you know, I feel as you be in a position of power and the person came directly to you, you could have addressed the situation head on, but you didn't. And so this person wanted to meet with me afterwards and basically said, you know, were you angry when you sent that email?
Yes.
It was very unprofessional and, you know, that type of thing. And it's like,
but how is it unprofessional to address an injustice that was done to you?
You know, because of communication, you know, how I address this person in that communication space impacted how they felt they should have responded in that situation, I guess. I don't know. It's not logical to me. But personally, you know, I said to her, I bring my culture, who I am. I embody that. That's in my communication. That's in the clothes I wear, how I do my hair. When I enter a space, I am who I am from my culture. And in my culture, we communicate very directly. You know, mm-hmm. ideas of professionalism are based on white men, middle to upper class. And mm-hmm. when you tell me that I didn't communicate something to you in a professional way, what you're really saying is I didn't meet your expectations of white man, middle to upper class. And so my email didn't have swear words. It just was blunt. And I said mm-hmm. to her, you know, how I told you in that email is how I would say it to anyone else. Higher than you, lower than you, doesn't matter. I would say it the same way. And so mm-hmm. we agreed from that discussion that anytime we were going to have a disagreement, we would do it in person. So if the person said something in an email that I felt, you know, I disagree with, I would come to this person face to face so that she could see my face. I'm not angry. My body language is not, you know, angry. I'm not posturing. I'm just giving you information about right. what I feel, you know. And so from
and
that,
yeah.
that's been a good thing that's come mm-hmm. out of it. It's hard work. It's tiring. But at least I'm seeing some kind of progress. At least I feel confident that as this person learns from their interactions with me, they might change their interactions towards other people.
Right. And so you spoke about trauma earlier and revolving around communication and things like that. How can people who have experienced trauma, maybe from someone else or from different experiences, how can they use communication to maybe heal through that or to get through that? What are like mm-hmm. some advice that you have for that?
I feel like there are three things. one in our community, communities of color, who are typically, you know, people typically marginalized or oppressed in society, we have learned and we have taught one another to suffer in silence, go through in silence. And we even silence each other. You know, when somebody talks about their trauma or, you know, mental health, illness, we tend to be like, oh, you're fine. Oh, that's not a big deal. You know, we don't need to talk about that, or those things aren't real. We silence each other. And so I think a lot of our healing starts when we give ourselves permission to talk back, to open up, to express what's inside of us, to bring that pain out and hold it in our hands and talk back to it. Like, what is the root of this? Where is this coming from? Who can help me heal? Until we get to the point where we can break the silence, I don't feel like healing can happen. And so encouraging each other and having people you can fall back on, who you can talk to me things about. Another thing I would say is love and trust. I feel like for any communication, if the love isn't there or the trust isn't there, you don't feel safe to express what's really real. And so in your inner circles, you know, being able to say maybe how this comes out, maybe how I express it isn't the best way, but you know it's always rooted in love. And the same thing for you. If you say something to me or you share a traumatic experience with me, and it could be a trauma that I've inflicted on you that I don't even know about, you know, if you're expressing that to me, as a person who loves you, as a person that you trust, it's my responsibility to take that in, process it, and for us to move forward in a way that builds the both of us.
Yeah. That is, yeah, I agree with that. And, yeah, because we have a responsibility, and, like, you know, what we say really does affect other people, and maybe, and it also does open doors to healing. If someone did something to us, even if it was years ago, we can always open that door for healing by just speaking up or just speaking about it or just sharing what has happened to us. So I do agree with that. And I do know that you did a lot of interpreting with ASL, right? Do you want to speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I did interpreting with American Sign Language, more community-based stuff. I worked with Spanish-speaking families who had deaf children. So a lot of my interpreting in that sense was Spanish to American Sign Language. But then as a Spanish-to-English interpreter, I worked in hospitals, so I was a medical-based interpreter, and a lot of my calls, I was on the overnight shift, so I would stay at home, and I would get a phone call any time of night, jump up, have to be to the hospital within 20 minutes. So a lot of my interpreting was trauma-based. I also did crisis interpreting overnight, so anytime a child or a vulnerable adult went into crisis, they would call the crisis line or a family member would call, and I would be the interpreter that went out. And so a lot of my interpreting experience has been in life or death situations where literally this person's life is in my hands. I have to be accurate. I have to know, you know, the cultural background that informs how they're communicating. I have to be able to communicate this in a clear and effective way for the person who's giving the crisis treatment or whatever the case was. And with the emergency room, you know, I would be showing up not knowing what the case was until I got there. And so communication was vital. Communication skills was literally what could make or break those situations.
Right. And so did you have, like, what experience, what was, like, a really big experience that happened to you that, like, stood out that kind of, like, I guess, I mean, working in hospitals and working in trauma, like, you probably go through so many different experiences. Like, what was one that really stood out to you?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there were so many. Mm-hmm. But I think, and a lot of people don't realize that interpreters experience trauma too. I think they mm-hmm. have a whole, like, field studying this now. But I remember I was married at the time, and I had been interpreting for this one client in the hospital for like 10 hours that day. And at some point, I realized the client was having a stroke throughout the mm-hmm. time that I was interpreting. And in the emergency room, you know, you're switching doctors, getting sent to this department for testing and coming back and seeing different nurses over a 10-hour, you know, shift, nurses change, staff change. And so I told the doctor, I said, you know, this patient was answering these questions perfectly fine 2 hours ago. You know, very cohesive, not a problem, no hesitation. And now all of a sudden the person is not able to answer as clearly. And so that triggered the doctor to investigate more, do an MRI. And they said, yes, for sure, this guy had been having a stroke over the time that I was there. And so it was like, wow, if I wasn't at my best that day, I mean, as an interpreter in the medical field, you have to be your best every day. But if I was off, if I wasn't, you know, paying attention to the signs that I was seeing, if I didn't have the what do you call it, I guess, the audacity, I don't know what they call it these days, but yeah. to speak up to the doctor and say something,
mm-hmm.
all these things, you know, were factors in saving this guy's life, literally. And so yeah. I remember leaving the hospital when the shift was over, and I got in my car, and I would always call my husband and tell him I was coming home. And I said to him, I said, I'm coming home, but I need like 15 or 20 minutes in the car just to get myself together. And he was like, I completely understand. And so after that case, I took like 6 months off from interpreting, just the weight of it, you know, the weight of, wow. I can't handle to see interpreters who just take this job lightly, you know, who
yeah.
just do it because they're good at language or whatever the case may be. It's literally a life in your hand. And so the weight mm-hmm. of it was just, I took time off. I had been interpreting for about 8 years at that point, and I just took time off. Like,
yeah. I can, man, that's very traumatic. Like, you got to take care of yourself, and I can see that. Like you said, literally his life was in your hands. Like, you are interpreting for this guy, and you're especially American Sign Language, like, that is in your hands, and you had to experience that. So, man, thank you so much for sharing that story with us. Like, just hearing everything, and I really appreciate you for being able to communicate. And I think that is one of your gifts, being able to talk to people, and healing through communication is very important. How did you get over like that? Like, how did you heal yourself, and how can others like heal themselves from some lack of communication or them not being able to get out what they say? I know I struggle a lot with communication. I love to listen to people, but sometimes when it goes to talking, even like on this podcast, you know, I sometimes struggle for words. So what advice do you have for people so that they can maybe move past certain situations or connect with people better, or to stand up in their community and to help heal it in the best way that they know how without being, so that they can be heard instead of just seen as that angry person or things like that? Like, what advice do you have, and like, what have you used to help you?
Yeah, I would say this is still part of my journey. Learning to heal myself. I tend to put people as priority even over my own healing. And it's interesting because a lot of times, like even now, like we're doing this podcast and I'm going through everything right now, you know?
Life.
Life just knocks you down. And those are the times when I'm working with people through their own healing. And so I don't get to focus on my healing so much until after the fact. And that's when I'm probably the most open to it. Because I think I toss the word around, like, yes, healing is important. You have to take care of yourself. But when it comes to myself, it's like, healing is actually work. It's a lot of work.
It's hard work.
It feels easier to just stay broke, you know, stay broken than to do the work of healing. And so when talking about communication, I'm like, I have all these tools in my toolkit from the languages that I've learned, from the experiences I've learned, from the people of these different cultures that have really shaped my worldview. Like, these tools help me to pinpoint. I can literally pinpoint every source of trauma in my life. And because I can do that, I can analyze it in a different way and say, how do I approach this in a way that's healthy for me and the people that are in my sphere? Because my life isn't independent of these people. And so I think having my child really forced me into focusing on self-healing more and not putting myself on the back burner. And so that's been a work in progress. And I would say to other people, as the child starts demanding my attention, I would say to other people, like, find people that you can lean on when you're going through this healing process, people that you can communicate with, who don't have expectations that it's going to be perfect, who don't have expectations that it's going to be coherent all the time, who you can just open up to about what you're going through, that you can just acknowledge the pain that you're in, the frustration you're in, whatever the feelings you're in with those people. Because they're going to be your support, and they're going to be the ones who are going to be with you through this healing process. But again, it comes back to having that trust as a foundation. Like, can you trust that you can lean on these people? Can you trust that you can fall on these people and they'll catch you? And I think that's where we fall short. A lot of people don't take the time to build that level of trust. And so that solves communication. You know, it's all connected.
Yeah, I agree. This was amazing. I want to thank you for getting on and extending the olive branch, sharing your story with us. And I think that this is a very important conversation on so many different levels, because sometimes we don't know the effects of our communication and what it can do for us and how it can really help to heal us and to help us get past things that we may be experiencing or things that we did not even know was trauma for us. And, you know, sometimes with words, like, they cause trauma to other people. Maybe someone was told that they're not going to be something when they get older, or maybe, you know, all they heard was negative things. And so, like, that comes a part of their DNA and their thoughts. So, communication is very important, and the work that you're doing is very needed. So I really, really, really appreciate you for doing that, and keep fighting, keep standing up to these people because they're going to learn today. But thank you guys for joining me again on Extending the Olive Branch, and you have heard Roshana share her story. If you would like to keep part of the conversation, or if you would like to be added on the show because you have a healing story, you can reach me at oliveoil_101 on Instagram, and that's OliveOyl_101. And also, Roshana, she's a doula, and she does translations, and this podcast will be available for an American sign. Is that how you say it? Yes. She will make it available for you guys. So do you want to give them your information?
Yes. So I am on Instagram at multilingual_doula. I talk on there in Spanish, American Sign Language, English, providing support for women of color who are currently pregnant, who recently gave birth. We're talking about breastfeeding coming up next week as it's Black Breastfeeding Week nationwide we're celebrating. So, yeah, if you want to join in a conversation, get some tips, be a part of the community, you can reach me at multilingual_doula on Instagram.
Hey, and that's the baby. Hi. Hey, girl. Thank you guys for joining. Bye.
My name is Glochanda, and I'm extending the olive branch.